Welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Bathsheba Monk. My guest tonight is Cindy Ross, author of 7 books, most recently The World is Our Classroom, How One Family Used Nature, Travel to Shape an Extraordinary Education. Welcome, Cindy, to Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great. This is a wonderful book, and I want to get into it. Of course, that's what we want to talk about. But first of all, the thing that comes across in this book mostly is that you've been around the world on foot or bike or anything without using gasoline, mostly to propel yourself. How did you get into that?
40 years ago, I hiked the Appalachian Trail as a rug rat, practically. I was in my early 20s and wrote my first book. I was an artist then, although I thought I was only an artist, so it has 125 drawings and it's all calligraphy. It's been in print for over 35 years, so that really started me down this path of, you know, adventure and travel.
Yeah.
And my husband's the same. He hiked it when he was 18 and 19, and so once you do something like that in your life, it changes you forever. And
can you talk about that a little more? Because I'm a person who likes to go to the post office maybe and to the corner, but what is it about doing these long walks that you find so appealing?
I think it's the time away from everything that happens out here. Like, my husband and I just got back from an 850-mile mountain bike ride, and although I like to listen to NPR and the news, it was really nice not to know what was happening because I didn't get sad or depressed or involved. And so, and you know, you think about your loved ones. Like, my daughter was in India on a Fulbright, and my son's at home, and we might talk to them like when we get to town, but for the most part, you really take a break from everything else in life and just walk or ride your bike and look for a place to camp. And, you know, you think, but it's almost like this day-long meditative state where you're moving and you're out in nature, and sure, it might be raining or hot sun, but it's so simple. You just have to keep going.
Yeah. And so did you find, like, I mean, you were an artist when you started this and you kept that up. Did you find a lot of inspiration for your art on these things? Or was it mostly just like meditative, like you said?
No, you know, I still paint landscapes and, of course, write all the time. And everything stimulates you as far as thinking. And if someone's with you, you know, we discuss things. But it's really like really pared down to like the simple life of just being. I mean, it sounds so esoteric, but yeah, it's really, you really take a break from everything. I mean, I don't think I could do like a 6-month hike like they do on the whole Appalachian Trail, Pacific Crest Trail. About a month or two is all we feel like cutting out right now, because we love what we do, our work and our lives at home. But it's really nice to take a break for a whole month.
So your whole life, basically, before we get into the book and the great subject about raising your children in this environment, but so that's your whole life, and that's what you basically design your life around?
Right. When our kids were 1 and 3, we walked across, we started to walk across the Rockies on the Continental Divide Trail, which is a national scenic trail. So for 5 years, we hiked 500 miles, and they rode llamas. And that was when we, you know, Todd and I, my husband, were long-distance hikers as before we were parents. And then when we took our kids out there the first time and we realized how much they were enjoying it and loving that lifestyle, that's what just set us down this path of trying to design a life where they could have outdoor adventures and keep traveling, mostly, you know, self-propelled if we could.
Yeah. So let's start talking about the whole impetus for this. Like, when you said the first time you took them out, they were 1 and 3. And so you're new parents, basically. Did you have like a grand plan? And you said, I want my children to be like, have these qualities, and therefore we're going to take them on this adventure? Or did you just want to go on an adventure and take your kids with you?
Yeah, they kind of went along for the ride back then. But it was, I mean, it was like the first week that we realized, oh my God, they're learning so much. Like we walked through an old burn. So we taught them about forest fires. We went past some dammed up ponds from beavers, and all over the place were trees, and you could, you know, the kids, even at one, could touch the wood and see the tooth marks and the shavings, and then look at the dam and see how it had filled up with silt. So it's like, wow, you know, we're not even trying, and we're teaching them so much about, but this was a natural world. And then we realized on that first trip how much, how big of an influence as a parent we had to teach them. We didn't plan on, we homeschooled till Sarah was 8, and then I got 2 book contracts, so they went to public school for 7 years, and then they taught themselves for the last 6. But the school system where we went was Blue Mountain in Schuylkill County. They never told me when I was allowed to take them out or not. Like, you know, you have 5 days for your for your extracurricular, and we used them up the first week. Like, they never went to school in September, and they missed like 70 days a year, and they didn't care because they were learning so much, which was unusual. But I was a family travel writer, so I said, you know, they have to come. So they didn't give me a hard time. So, you know, we started right in the beginning from that first trip, you know, and then it just built from there.
And so did they have to report back in school, like what they did on their trek?
They tried to. It was really kind of sad because, like, one year we went to the Yucatan and went bicycling all over the place, and Sierra wanted to come back, and, you know, she had artifacts and gifts and things like that to share with her Spanish class. But because they had a, you know, a curriculum and had to do their testing, they couldn't find one half an hour for her to share what she learned. And that's when the teachers started to tell me that I should think about pulling them out and homeschooling them, because it was too much for them to go back and forth all the time.
Yeah, from the to the different environments. So after that first trek that you took with them on llamas, first of all, let me ask you, how did you get llamas?
Well, so we met a llama trainer in the Berks County, and I was complaining that I couldn't go backpacking anymore because we had these little tiny kids, and he was from Colorado, and he overheard me, and he said that the Colorado Llama Association is trying to promote llama packing, and he said, I bet they would help you, like, do the Colorado Trail, which is 500 miles. And I said, well, you know, we have diapers. And he said, you know, they'll take care of you. You get to a road, they'll pick you up, and you can go home with them. And I didn't believe it, but that's what happened. And they sponsored us for just the Colorado Trail. But we were out for 1 week when we said, we love this. And we went home with llamas. We bought a trailer, and we bought llamas before we even came back to Pennsylvania. And decided from then on we were going to go up to the Montana-Canadian border and then head down towards Mexico. And then every summer we would do 500 miles. So that first year in Colorado was part of the whole National Scenic Continental Divide trip, but we weren't planning on doing any more than that at the time.
So that was like your first trip with the children, and it was a success. And what made you think it was a success?
Well, we did it. We accomplished
you finished
it.
Okay.
And they were happy. They were extremely happy out there. I mean, I was afraid that my kid would walk off a cliff, and I thought, do I put one of those dumb harnesses on him? You know, I just didn't know. He was 1 and a half, and he was in his dad's backpack because he was too little to ride a llama, because he would just get off if he didn't want to be on it. So he had to wait till he was 3 before he could ride. But, you know, I mean, he put glass in his mouth at fire pits and things like that. And we said, spit it out. And he did. And it was okay. So, you know, they're pretty resilient kids. We never even used a Band-Aid in 5 years on the trail in 3,100 miles. So, and they never got sick. So it's a pretty safe environment, actually.
Oh, and you weren't scared of, like, bears or?
Well, we were scared of grizzly bears and mountain lions, but we learned through wildlife specialists how to act and behave, not let the kids walk first. They had to be, like, sandwiched in between us when we were going, like, through Glacier National Park and things like that.
So they're not an easy pick.
Right, and we didn't know that grizzlies didn't know they could eat llamas or horses yet. So, you know, we would put the llamas, like, around our camp. And they all naturally face different directions for safety. Like, if you have 2, they go back to back. If you have 4, they'll go in 4 directions all by themselves. So we would surround ourselves with the llamas in camp in case we would have a bear and they would eat the llama first. You know? That never happened, though.
Oh, good. Okay. So, all right. So tell me how you, because this is of vital interest to me, going out into the woods. How do you deflect a bear? I mean, if you're walking, say a bear comes up to you.
Well, we always had to make noise. You know, we had bells. We sang. You know, you had to let them know you were coming. So there were closures all over the campgrounds where we were through the park because of bear trouble. But we never saw. But the llamas would go crazy. They have a warning call, and so they were like, you know, like on high alert for the 100 miles that we went through there because they were out there. We just didn't see them.
Uh-huh, but they were very much aware of them.
Yeah.
So the first trip, you knew that your kids were happy. And there was one part in the book where you said that when you were inside, this was later, in your house, and Sierra, I think your daughter, she was crying. And you took her outside, and she immediately got quiet. That
was when she was pretty much first born, Bathsheba. It was like, you know, she has colic, and the kid never slept more than like a half an hour. And we would take her out at night, and she would just stop and just look around, even though you couldn't see anything because we live in the woods. But just being outdoors. And then we took her on her first backpacking trip when she was, I guess, just, you know, a couple months old. We did the Loyal Sock Trail, and she was happy as could be out there.
So you knew that this was certainly wasn't hurting her, let's put it that way. And she was learning things. Let me see. When you said too, like when you were growing up, I want to go back just a little bit. Did you grow up around here or?
I grew up outside of Reading in mm-hmm. Pennside, mm-hmm. in just an old suburb. Like my dad had a hunting camp, and he taught me about nature just from going up there. And you know, my girlfriend that I grew up with in high school, we always wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail. I still belong to the Blue Mountain Eagle Hiking Club, which is Berks County's one hiking club since I was 15. And I remember when I was 15, I was up around the Hawk Mountain area and I saw my first through hiker. And that was when I thought, wow, I really would like to do that someday. So I grew up, you know, with those little seeds that were planted. And mm-hmm. then, you know, once you decide you're doing something like that and you do it, it completely changes you.
You keep doing it. So you said, too, your father had a hunting cabin.
Up in Potter County.
Uh-huh. Did you? Oh, boy, that's beautiful up there. Did you hunt with him?
I wasn't allowed to till I was 16.
Okay.
The guys wouldn't let me come to camp till then, but.
Okay, so this was a question I had, and you never really addressed it in your book, was, how do you reconcile like hunting with being in the natural world? Do you consider that part of the natural world if you eat what you kill?
Yeah.
That's basic.
You have to. We had a house sitter while we were mountain biking, and we used to sit out in our orchard and knock off squirrels for something to do. And I said, if you're going to kill anything on our property, it better be in the pot on the stove. That's the rule. Or don't shoot it.
Yeah. So you're not vegetarians or anything like that. No. Mm-hmm. Do you... And I also read in your book, you grow your own food mostly.
Yeah, we have a pretty big an orchard and a big garden, yeah.
And so what did your day look like when your children were young? I mean, I know you're a writer and you had book contracts and stuff. So how did you juggle all that? What was your schedule like?
Well, see, what was really amazing was that, like, I write for Pennsylvania Magazine for a long time, and I used to write for Lehigh Valley Magazine, Harrisburg Magazine, Berks County Living. I would think about, number one, what my kids were interested in or what was happening around the whole area. Like, Sierra was really into, she had this sixth sense of finding things ever since she was really little. Like, when she was six, we were on a mountain bike trip, and we were in New Mexico, and Todd's yelling, "Let's go, we're going. She goes, "No, I'm going to find a point. I'm going to find an arrowhead." And it's like, "Sierra, come on." And she goes, "Okay, I found it." And she found a 2,000-year-old obsidian bird point. And it's like, how did that child know that? So she was always like that when she was little. So I would take her on archaeological digs, like around the Susquehanna River, so she could learn something. And then I would do a magazine story. So I was always working when I was teaching them. Like, we went up to New York and did a thing on women's suffrage in the Underground Railroad. So that whole week was history credit. Mm-hmm. And I was writing for magazines up there. So I combined the two and taught them whatever I wanted to, whatever they wanted to, and could find a way to write a story about it.
Yeah. So you did get your writing done, and then they were... it seems like they were very good, even when they were young, at entertaining themselves.
Always, because we never had a TV. Mm-hmm. And the 5 years, the five summers they spent on the trail, they had to figure out how to entertain themselves, whether it was telling stories or writing or drawing or just, you know, wandering, like looking around. They spent their childhood doing that out in nature. And I know that's what changed them.
Yeah. Or it seems kind of like, well, your son Bryce became an artist, or he was an artist, and he found that in himself. And your daughter Sierra became a naturalist, is that right?
No, she's a geographer and an anthropologist.
Oh, I see. Okay.
She studies climate disaster. And right now she was on a Fulbright studying artificial glaciers in Ladakh in the Himalayas.
Oh, okay. Are you in touch with her?
Well, she's coming home in 2 weeks. Yeah, I was out visiting her twice in India.
Oh, that's very cool. So do you ever think, we're kind of getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I want to ask this question. I don't want to forget. Do you think that they would have been something else if they hadn't had this kind of natural upbringing?
Yeah, probably normal.
Some people say that is being an artist and a geographer is normal, right?
I don't know. They don't seem normal. They're their own, you know, boss already at a young age, and want to, you know, understand that they're in charge of their happiness and are working to design their lives for freedom and to try to bring greater good or beauty to the world. Like, I always taught them that I'm giving you this amazing childhood, but you can't just like coast through life. You have to be responsible and make the world a better place. That's your job.
We're taking a quick break here. I'm Bathsheba Monk. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails, discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 7 or wdiy.org. Thank you.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're talking tonight to Cindy Ross, whose latest book is The World is Our Classroom, How One Family Used Nature and Travel to Shape an Extraordinary Education. So, Cindy, we were talking about your children and how they learned differently. You took them out of public school and homeschooled them, and then they taught themselves and supplemented their education with like nature learning. But you also did other things like international travel. And could you tell us about that? Like when you decided you were going to take a trip with your kids?
Well, we went on our first international trip when they were 3 and 5. I met an American Czech up in Vermont. He was doing research for what Americans wanted and needed in a bed and breakfast, because it had been 5 years since the Czech people got their country back, and they were creating this greenway from Vienna, Austria to Prague. And he gave me his card and said, you know, maybe you can come over and write some stories for us. And I just threw them on my desk, the card, and my husband was cleaning the desk off it on New Year's to make me be a neater person. And I said, give me that card, I'm going to call Lubomir. And so he invited our whole family over for almost a month, and we hiked and cycled this whole greenway. We took our bike trailer with us. The kids were 3 and 5. There's a big story in the book about it, how hard it was. And we thought, geez, if we can do this with someone else in charge of us, and our kids are so little, we could probably figure out how to do it on our own and be in charge of our trip. So that was our first international experience, and it was very challenging until we got them to do what we needed to do. Like, he didn't know what he was doing. Like, he would say, okay, we're going to hike 25 miles in a day. And there were other people.
25 miles?
Yeah, without a break, yeah. And I said, we can't do it. And no one else could do it either. So we kind of mutinied. And then he said, okay, we'll do what you want to. So we designed the whole trip. But they didn't know what they were doing. So once that happened, it was better.
But they never had children like this young.
No, they never yeah. led, you know, a press trip, which was a big press trip, you know, for all those weeks.
Okay. And so you wrote about this, and that's where you're kind of unique, is that you travel and you hike with your kids too, right? And then you write about it.
Right. Right? I mean, we cycled the Camino when they were 12 and 14. That was their first trip, where the way of St. James across Spain, when they were on their own bicycles. And right, I would write magazine articles about all these trips.
Yeah, so that makes you sort of a pioneer in this, taking your kids along.
Right. Well, no one ever certainly took them across the Rockies with
right.
babies. Probably no one ever will either. Although there's big families now. There was one family, I think, of eight. It was the largest family ever that has finished in the Appalachian Trail. So, and it was really funny, Bethsheba. One time I was out doing trail work, and I was like 2 years ago, and there was this family of like four kids, and I go, wow, that's great. You know, you're out here with your family. And there was a couple teenagers who looked like they weren't, you know, totally pleased. And I said to the mom, I go, like, what made you do this? And she goes, I read this book, Scraping Heaven. And I go, really? And I said, well, that would be my book. And the kids are looking at me like, it's because of you we're out here. She was so flustered, but I was pretty shocked too. But I was happy to see that somebody, you know, was following in our footsteps and thought it was important to bring your kids out for a long journey.
Yeah, to see this stuff. Well, that brings me to another point that you talk about in your book, about you were lucky that everybody in your family enjoyed doing this stuff. They enjoyed traveling.
Well, I don't think that was luck. I mean, we started, like I said, Sierra when she was born. So they just grew up in a backpack. I mean, Todd used to mow our pasture with Sierra in the back. One time he came in and she was like a baby, like, you know, like a month or two old. And he goes, something's wrong. And I looked at her and she's like gagging. And I put my finger down her throat and pulled out some leaves. So while he was like, you know, trimming, you know, the orchard, she decided to eat leaves. So they grew up out there. And I think that part of the problem with parents who say their kids don't like it is they wait too long, you know, and they wait till they have an opinion. And then, you know, like Richard Louv, a friend of mine who wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder, he said that, you know, kids say, I want to play indoors because that's where the electric outlets are. So, you know, kids are
that's
raised
how they play.
Inside. Yeah. But, you know, the best way to take a kid outside is to go with them. So we took them out immediately.
So they knew there wasn't anything to be scared of. I guess that's what most kids are. Yeah.
No.
You have a great story, if you would tell it, please, about the beaver story where your daughter was following the beaver around. And then she went to a friend who showed her one on the computer.
Right. It was like a CD-ROM about learning about wild animals. And she was young. She was only three. And she had like a little Instamatic little kitty camera. And she stood by on top of the beaver dam for like a long time waiting for the beaver to come out with a sprig in its mouth. And it was really close. And she turned around. She goes, got it. And this was before digital cameras. And I go, well, you don't know if you have it until we develop the film. But, you know, at least you were there. And then, you know, we went home and went to visit some friends in New Jersey. And they knew we were out on the trail. But they just, you know, it's a different world and mindset. And they said, come in and see our new, you know, CD program. And the kids are showing them about beavers. And they would click on, you know, beavers make dams. And, you know, and they thought this was so wonderful. And Sierra's looking at me crooked like, we know a lot about beavers making dams because we watched them, you know, in real life. And this is great, but it's not exciting for us. We'd rather have the real deal and have the experience.
And so it's like, did your children have computers growing up, or was that?
No.
No, not at all.
They didn't have smartphones until, they didn't have cell phones till they went to college and said they didn't want them. And even then, Sierra said, you know, I don't want, what's it called? Texting, because she said, I have problems because people say they're going to meet me to go somewhere and then I go and then they send me a quick text and say, oh, sorry, you know, I'm not in the mood anymore, instead of communicating and you know, fessing up that, you know, you're just blowing your friend off. And she goes, I don't want to live like that. I want people to communicate. So get rid of texting. So no, our kids, I mean, I had a computer, but they had no interest in computers at all.
Really? Even
no.
The internet?
No, they had no interest in a television. They wanted to do their own creative thing all the time.
Uh-huh. So your son now is a designer,
is
an
artist,
an illustrator. So how does he do that without a computer?
He has a computer.
Now he does.
Yeah. But still, he's not. He doesn't like play on it. Like his he never knows where his phone even is to answer it. So they're not. They're not married to their technology and devices.
Yeah, that must be. Is that something that you, when you give talks about this, that you emphasize? Is that that might be a good thing?
Well, you know, it really, it's the parents are just as bad. You know, how many times do you go into a restaurant, people aren't talking to each other and they're playing on their phones? And there was this one great restaurant in Chestnut Hill outside Philly, and it's like, you know, you enter the restaurant, it's this great little Irish bar, and you put your phone in the basket. It's like, no kidding, there's no phones. And, you know, you talk to each other in this restaurant.
Yeah.
So the parents, you know, if we want our kids to read books, we have to read books. If we want them to play music, we have to. If we want them to talk to each other, we've got to get rid of our phones, too. So
is that like the big lesson from raising your children like this without computer technology and out in the wilderness, is that whatever you do, they're going to follow.
It happens with everybody, but yeah. I saw it right away.
And maybe that's why they like you. What do you think?
I don't know. We're pretty close. My daughter doesn't get out of bed in India until she calls me first thing. So even like on a WhatsApp on our phone, so she talks to me constantly, even though she's far away. So
you're still close.
Oh yeah, and my son, yeah.
Yeah, so that's really lucky. Now, when you were traveling too in Czechoslovakia, you mentioned this in passing, and this really stuck out at me that somebody had a taxidermy and they had cats and squirrels dressed up in outfits. Like, how did your children react to that after? And you played it straight. You didn't say anything about it.
Well, it was amazing. There was like, I don't know, like 100 of them, and there was cats playing cards and dressed up and dogs and you know, it didn't take long, even as a 3 and 5 year old, to realize that there's so many fascinating things in the world and people and stuff like that, that, you know, they got it right away that everybody wasn't like them, which I think is one of the tragedies of kids nowadays being raised, that, you know, if anybody's different, if anybody's a different color, has a different, you know, dress, the way they dress or a different religion, it's like foreign to them and they can't understand. I mean, that's one wonderful thing about raising kids outside of a public school, because they have friends that are all different ages and they learn to talk to everybody and accept everybody. So that's one of the downfalls of a regular school like that, where they only think they have to have friends that are the same age, and it's so such a big, you know, lack in their lives.
Right. Well, especially like you have a chapter in here about different faiths, exposing your children to people of different faiths. Would you talk about that? Like the first trip was to Morocco.
Right.
Where you lived with a Muslim family.
Right.
So what was that? How did they respond to
we had a friend who he has a business called I Like You Tours, where he immerses families or people into the culture. So they do a lot of homestays. And so we were with this one family, and it was really neat. They were growing, you know, marijuana, and it was okay. But, you know, you were supposed to pretend you didn't see it, you know. And my kids love to play this card game called Drug Dealer. And it's like, we got to like call it something else. Cause you didn't have to speak the language. You like would communicate with your eyes, like who was a drug dealer or not. And it was that kind of thing where like, okay, so, and this was before anybody was legalizing marijuana, you know, medical marijuana, you know, it was like 15 years ago. And so they realized that there are so many different cultures and you know, we could be, and everybody, there was 3 people in the family named Muhammad. And then because you're supposed to name your firstborn Muhammad, and there was like a blended marriage. So it's like, well, that's weird. You know, we all want to have like a unique, you know, name here in America, but, you know, and they did the same thing with the women. I forget the name of the women. It began with an F. So, and that was like, you know, that was part of their culture. So mm-hmm. being with these families, we didn't go to any, we went to mosques, but of course we couldn't go to any of the services there. But when they would do something like play drug dealer cards with a family that they couldn't speak anything, but they did know the Akon lyrics and were doing rap together.
Really, the children were.
So then they realized that, you know, it doesn't matter if they're Muslims, they're kids, and we found something of commonality, you know, just between playing cards and singing songs together.
Yeah.
So that was real important to me that they learned that from an early age. I mean, that was before we had so much trouble in our country about different cultures and religions and things like that. But, you know, I think it was before 9/11, you know, when we were over there.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I think so.
How did they respond to your children? I mean, to Americans, like being over there, Americans, was there any criticism?
Oh my gosh, no. They were like, you know, like took Bryce's baseball hat and put it on backwards and, you know, hanging on each other and hugging each other. No, they were completely bonded right away. And it was like that in Thailand when they were really little too. They were playing like volleyball with an empty plastic water bottle because they didn't have a birdie. And it was like, that's okay. We can play ball with them out here, even though we can't speak to, you know, with each other. So they always found ways to communicate with the kids.
That's so interesting. So how about the Amish? You said you went to visit some Amish families.
We did some bicycle trips through there, which is really interesting, too.
That's in Lancaster?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they even have some Mennonite Pennsylvania Farmstay farms that you can stay with. And then they have Amish girls that come in and feed you breakfast. So that was really neat to be traveling. And you know, other places around the world were the same, where they would see us as being closer to them and not being some rich American in a fancy car. Like, it was that way when we went through the Navajo country when we were on the Great Divide mountain bike trail, too. Even though we had these $3,000 tandem mountain bikes that we got for free to ride about them, they looked at us as rich Americans, but the kids were playing together in the yard like, you know, their wash line was a piece of barbed wire. I know. But, you know, that was in the book where they were little then. They were 6 and 8. And we had this big discussion like, are we poor? I thought we were poor, but they're really poor. So what is poor and what is a want and what is a need? And do we have everything we need, but it doesn't matter about wants. So, you know, at 6 and 8, being there with those Native Americans that were so poor, they invited us to spend the night there, and they put an American flag up to welcome us because it's a foreign country. You know,
that's interesting.
Yeah, it was. So, you know, from the very beginning when they were little, you know, and I always talk to my kids. So we would have these experiences, and we would talk, discuss them. And so they always thought about life and people and situations.
Yeah. And so they realized then how they were in the world as Americans, as different people, that they're different. I think that's like the best education you can give a kid, actually, is to put them someplace else.
You know, my mom used to get those Family Circle and Women's Day magazines when I was young. And there was a woman there that wrote a story that she put a question. Her daughter was 12 years old and she was starting to have attitude and didn't appreciate what she had, didn't care for her parents the right way. And the one woman that wrote back said, when they hit puberty, you should take them to a developing country. And they will forever be a different adult because they will see what they have and they will appreciate it and they will understand how. And, you know, in Mexico, when we were in the Yucatan, we're riding our bikes. You could look into the houses and there was like a hammock and that was it. But the kids were happy. And it's like, how can they be so happy and they're so poor? It's like, well, they don't need anything else right now. As long as they have something to eat and they have shelter and someone that cares about them, that's enough. So it was important lessons when they were little.
Do they keep in touch with any of these kids that they met? Or
no.
Not so much? No.
They were too little back then.
They were
then.
Too little,
They
yes.
did for a while, some of them.
Yeah. So you also went to find out about your ancestors. Can you talk about that a little bit?
My parents died a long time ago, like over 35 years. So my kids never knew them. And my husband is Pennsylvania German and Swiss. And they're pretty Pennsylvania German and Swiss. I mean, they behave pretty, you know, stoic and everything. And they would look at mom, who was Sicilian and Polish, and try to understand, like, I'm not yelling. I'm just, you know, I'm having emotion in my voice. This isn't yelling. So I thought, you know what? You're not going to really get it till we go and to the country and find the relatives. And it was so enlightening for my kids to meet their relatives and to understand who I am and who their dad is, and that they're a combination. And when they feel like not communicating because they're internal thinking, you know, that's their dad's side of the family, and that's okay too. So I think it's really important for them to understand who came before them and who their people went into creating who they are today. Mm-hmm. And then you can, then they can decide, you know, who they want to be and what they want to develop more. You know, if they don't want to be an introvert and a quiet
they don't have
German,
to be.
No, they can develop their Italian side.
There's a really beautiful, I think it was an essay by Sierra in here about how she's looking at all these Sicilians and she sees parts of you in each of them. I think that's just so lovely because that's really...
It was really amazing though. It's like, oh my God, she's got my calves and that one's got my chin. It was really weird. They never met him before either.
Yeah.
But then you realize, you know, how much of you is genetic and how much of you is, you know, just environmental. And they're both really strong. And you can't, like, deny that, you know, this isn't who you are from your DNA and also what happened to you growing up. But going forward, you can design your life about how you want to behave and who you want to be.
You're not prisoner to it either, though. You can make a conscious choice about it. So that was really lovely. And then your Polish family, you visited them.
Right.
And so
that's one of the things that I always talked about whenever I spoke and when I hope gets across in this book that, you know, I've met so many people throughout my life that act as though they're victims of their life. And, oh, I would have hiked the Appalachian Trail, but, you know, it's like, you know what? But if you really want to do it, you guys just decide. And this is, you know, you can, unless you're, you know, in such a terrible situation in life that you can't seem to dig yourself out of it, you can, you're responsible
you
for your
it.
Happiness and designing a life that you want. And I told my kids that, I think Sarah was like 6 years old and she goes, I've been miserable all day, mommy, and I've been waiting for you to make me happy. And I go,
that's not good.
I want you to understand right now, you're in charge of your happiness, even as a 6 year old. I'll help you, but you have to decide you don't want to be like this. And I want them to understand that you know, design a life that makes you happy.
Let's take a little break here. I'm Sheba Monk. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse.
The many choices and real voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're talking tonight with Cindy Ross, the author of The World is Our Classroom, How One Family Used Nature and Travel to Shape Our Extraordinary Education. So you basically believe, Cindy, in, and you did, you practice it, taking your children out of the formal classroom and just throwing them into experiences. And what lessons did they learn, like specifically? I know that you can't really measure it. It's mostly intuitive. But like, for example, being around nature all the time, what lessons did they take from that?
Well, one of the stories in the book is about climbing this mountain in Yosemite called Half Dome. And Todd and I had been up it before, and we spent the night up there when you were allowed to. And my son always wanted to climb the mountain. It's a quarter mile up these cables that you have to hold on to and pull yourself up. And people have died. And I mean, they don't die all the time, but they have died. And we got there and it was raining. And so we kind of waited to see if the sun was going to come out and if, you know, it was able to go. And it was one of those iffy things that we're not sure about our decision here. But, you know, so he saw the process of weather and being exposed to it and making a decision about something in life that could impact us the rest of our lives.
So you don't throw a tantrum when something
right. Or, you know, this critical thinking about stuff like this, you know, like my kids learn that at an early age because we would we were on the Continental Divide Trail, and you know, we had to ford rivers where there were no bridges, and there were times where we would go over a pass and we had to take care of the llamas because they were being meatheads. And the 3 and 5 year old, we said, okay, just hike and try to pick the right route over the pass. And they could, because they could look at the land, even at little kids, and figure out where to go. So
by following your example from before.
From before, right. But, you know, and it's all these other things, like I said in the book, that it doesn't matter if your kids know how to read a compass or can find direction or anything like that. But it matters if they have confidence, or if they believe in themselves, or they understand that this is uncomfortable, but it'll pass. I mean, there's all these virtues about learning important things in life that, you know, they're not going to need to know how to negotiate the Continental Divide, but they'll have to figure out what to do about an issue, whether they should quit their job because they're unhappy, or what to do in a relationship. And they have to think critically and understand that you have to work at things, or things, you know, pass that's hard, you know, because so many people nowadays, they don't want to be uncomfortable for any length of time. They don't want to have hardship. And I mean, that kind of stuff teaches you a lot of things too, and makes you a stronger person, so that when things happen, because things happen all the time that you have no control over, whether you're people right in our Schuylkill County at Pine Grove, I mean, it's flooding like crazy. Well, they didn't think they were going to be, you know, who knows? But what are you going to do with this now? And do you have the skills and the virtues and the character to be able to figure out what to do?
Yeah. And how to maybe push yourself a little bit.
And help each other, too.
Yeah, and help each other. Do they, do you consider them good team players?
Oh, yeah.
Because of that?
Yeah.
So everybody, like, knows what they have to do to survive in the wilderness.
And they understand the whole value and importance of communicating, too. You know, because I'm working with both my kids with their significant others that weren't raised the same way. And it's like, you got to talk, you know. So they understand things like that, too, because of how they were raised.
Yeah. How about, from animals? I learn things from my cat all the time. I think a lot of my behavior is, like, on a cat level. Do you see anything like that in the wilderness when you're observing other animals, like even llamas or...
Yeah, and they realize, I mean, it happens to people and their dogs and cats all the time, the value of having a relationship with something that you are responsible for, and their safety and their well-being. So that level of empathy, just caring for something, like our kids rode llamas for 2,600 miles. So Sarah really cared about her llama, because we would take him across snow traverses and narrow little bridges, and he kept her safe. So you know, and also being a place where something could eat you, where you're not at the top of the food chain, is an important lesson to learn out there as a kid, or anybody.
And you don't necessarily kill the enemy in that case. Yeah,
it's their home first anyway.
Right, that's a tough lesson, I think, for people to learn. So did your children have any trouble, like, transitioning from that kind of environment to college?
No, they didn't have any trouble in college at all. They were having trouble in school because the girls are different than boys. You know, boys' stuff just rolls right over them. But Sierra, the girls got jealous because she missed so many days of school, and they didn't care. The administration didn't care. But they decided that they wouldn't talk to her anymore, and so she was really unhappy. And that finally was what I decided to let them get out of school, because I said, you know, I'm not interested in sitting there learning algebra. I'm not doing it. You must be responsible. I will be your facilitator, but you are responsible for your education. And Pennsylvania has one of the strictest homeschool laws in the country, which is great. So, you know, they were in charge of their education. And like Sierra gave me attitude the first year, and she goes, "What have you done for my education?" I said, go add up your field trips. So she came back, she goes, "We had 125. And I go, "Okay."
That's
so,
what you did.
Yeah. So, you know, that was the only thing. They transitioned wonderfully into Temple University in honors. They both went there. And And what's
they eventually learned algebra?
No, they didn't have to. That was what was great about homeschooling. You know, you could learn how to balance a checkbook or build a goat shed and do the math. And as long as you were doing math, you didn't have to. You didn't have to do chemistry. You didn't have to do physics. Like Bryce studied extreme weather because that's what he liked. So you had your sciences and things like that, but you could pick what you wanted to focus on. Yeah. So then a kid, he's learning, but they can decide personally what they're interested in. So they have so much freedom in learning what they want to learn.
Mm-hmm. When they got to college, though, so they were prepared for all the classes that they had to take, especially like Sierra. Didn't she have a lot of science and math?
Well, she started out in journalism and writing.
Oh, okay. Where?
But she didn't have to. She didn't have to take any sciences as in an anthropology major.
Until later.
No, never.
No, never. Mm-mm. Oh, okay. So. I don't know why I assumed
they never had to take anything they didn't want to. They're pretty lucky.
So what would they do differently if they did they ever say they would do that they wish they were raised differently?
No,
or that
absolutely
you,
not.
And what about you? What do you think?
It was the best thing I ever did. And we were nervous about letting them quit school and teach themselves.
Because, that's a really foreign concept to me. But
well, I know, and I have two wonderful PhD friends who were in child psychology and education that coached me for years. They said, "You can do it. They'll do it, and you won't have any problem getting into school." And we didn't. I mean, Sarah got so many scholarships. She won two $10,000 private scholarships. She won a National Science Foundation grant for 3 years at Boulder for her master's. We never paid for school because of who they were and what they learned in life, because you get cherry-picked out. I mean, you can have great SAT scores and AP scores, but if you're homeschooled or teach yourself, you get pulled out, and they look at your private little portfolio differently. And so they love homeschooled or world schooled kids because they're self motivators and self, you know, they love learning. And so they throw the money at you then too, because they know you're going to shine in their school.
Is that one thing? I didn't know that. Is that one thing they have to do? Is like a portfolio of experiences?
I don't know if they have to, but we did. And so we did everything like that we could do to help.
To factor. So now here they are. They're adults. They're
26 and 28. 20
and 28, yeah. And they're married, or they have partners.
One's married.
Yeah. So, and they're not with people who were raised the same way. Now, if they have children, say this is hypothetical, though, would they push to raise their children the same way, do you think?
They would probably want to be involved because they know how wonderful it was. They know at this point that they had an amazing life and education. Mm-hmm. And they might have not realized it as they were growing up, but they understand it. And I think the last straw was when they read my book, because, you know, when I was putting the book together, Bathsheba, and I would think like, okay, so if I want to talk about what lessons in life taught them empathy, I mean, I had to look through 25 years of my journals of their huge portfolios that they had to show to the public school supervisor every year. I mean, they were like 2 inches thick. They wrote about everything we ever did, and not just wrote like a summary, but they wrote, you know, like an essay about what they learned. I mean, they turned into amazing writers because I made them write about it.
You have essays in here that they wrote.
Right.
They
That's one thing
fabulous.
I really wanted to do in the book is show their voice and not just this mother saying, oh, you know, what a great way this is to raise and educate your kids. And so I think when starting about 12 or 13, I have, you know, essays and excerpts from their journals in there.
That they wanted to do. This seems like it just seems intuitively to make sense to me. is anybody else doing this? Are there any programs? I mean, is there like a grassroots thing going on?
There's a lot. So we never fit into the normal homeschooling groups because a lot of them do it for religious reasons. And mm-hmm. we just wanted to do it for freedom and independence and to teach them, you know, show them the whole world. But there are some, but there's not that many organizations, depending on where you live. But mm-hmm. There's people doing it, but they're not staying put. You know, there's some that families that just travel all over the world and they teach their kids along the way too.
But it seems like a lot of the stuff that you're talking about in this book, like world travel and being like one with nature and knowing nature and being self-sufficient, there should be some way to get these lessons and put them into the public school. Is there any vehicle for input?
Well, when our kids were in public school, we would work really hard to do some interesting assemblies. Like we put up we have a big teepee. We put up our teepee and we cook some Native American food. We brought our llamas into an assembly and gave them a presentation on what it was like to live out there as a little kid and travel in the wilderness. So we put on workshops like that in our school and other schools around. But I think since our kids left, you know, there's not that much time for field trips anymore. And that's not true. I know from Richard Louv's movement, there are a lot of schools that are understanding the need for nature study. And I know, like, the environmental education centers, like Jacobsburg in your county here, mm-hmm. does some great things. So I think a lot of these other organizations have stepped it up so that the kids would have to come when they're not in school. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure what it's like in school. All I hear is bad things, like the kids don't get to be outside much anymore, or
recesses.
Right. And they took away their field trips. Because I remember back then, my girlfriend, their field trip was to the grocery store to learn about the four food groups. And I go, are you kidding? At least go to a dairy farm.
And learn where it doesn't come from a bottle. It comes from
A story in there where the one poor little girl thought that, you know, milk was cow's urine. And it's like, let's just start at the basics.
I know. I'm trying to think. There must be some way to like get this in. But I guess it doesn't really happen until you get involved in school boards and
I really think the parents need to really be the ones to do it. They need, I think, you know, any parent that really loves their kids would like to spend more time with them anyway. Everyone's so busy that, you know, to take your kids out when there's a new moon to try to look for a meteorite shower and go lay in a field. I mean, my biggest memories, happiest memories of the last 25 years are experiences with my kids. And I mean, I couldn't get enough of being with them, and I was with them all the time. So mm-hmm. I mean, I adore my kids; they're my best friends next to my husband, and because of it, they're happy, healthy kids that, you know, have a wonderful relationship with their parents, which is, you know, there's most parents would rather have a better relationship right now with their kids.
Yeah.
So I mean, the schools are important, but really, the parents have more control and power over how they raise their kids than the schools do.
Yeah. So maybe this book is like a first salvo into that war of getting parents more aware that they have to be more involved and maybe take their cell phones away from their kids and get them to see.
Go spend some time with them.
Yeah. So spending time, you think, is maybe the biggest thing. It doesn't even matter what you're doing, really. Oh, there is one thing I wanted to say. I wanted to ask you, too, before I forgot. Bryce is an artist. Did you do field trips to museums with him?
Oh, yeah. We did everything.
Yeah. So he got to see all of that. And he got to.
Because my background is fine arts. I went to Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, so I'm a landscape painter. But, I mean, we did everything. You know, films, art, everything, science centers.
Anything he was interested in, you just.
Just period. We just did everything. Just
in front of him. Yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah, so now that your kids are gone and they're like all different parts of the world, what's next for you? What are you doing?
Well, when I turned 60, I said, you know, I'd really like to bring in the next decade fit. So my husband said, well, let's ride the Great Divide mountain bike trail and go back to the Rockies 20 years later. So the last three summers, we've been riding from Jasper down to Mexico. And we just got back last week from an 850-mile mountain bike trip that we had all our gear with us and rode through the mountains. So,
oh, my God. How long did that take you?
It was only 3 weeks. We did 850 miles. We went pretty fast this year. So got stuff going. My grandmother lived to be 102, and she said, stop moving and you die. So I don't plan to stop moving.
So you're going to, okay, keep doing this stuff. when the book comes out, and it's out now.
At the end of the month.
At the end of August. So you're going to do some speaking engagements?
Yes, I'm available to speak at any organization or group, all different topics, whether it's education or outdoors or, you know, environmental centers or whatever. But I have one particular one in Schuylkill County where the two, Schuylkill County Conservation Association and the Watershed, is hiring me to speak at Penn State Schuylkill on September 13th at 7 p.m. And I'll be talking about how we use the local land, the Blue Mountain, the Schuylkill River, different programs to teach our kids. And that's open to the public and free. And the Nature Center in Berks County on October 18th at 7 p.m. I will be speaking at Firefly Bookstore in Kutztown. It's on my website, which is CindyRossTraveler.com.
You have an events listed where
right.
they can. And you're also going to be at Moravian Bookshop sometime in September, maybe.
Maybe.
So it was a real pleasure talking to you, Cindy. And we were talking to Cindy Ross tonight, and her latest, her seventh book, is The World is Our Classroom, How One Family Used Nature and Travel to Shape an Extraordinary Education. Thank you, Cindy, for talking to us.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
I'm Bathsheba Monk. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse.